I'm the assistant curator for interpretation at Arnolfini. One Day Sculpture is the third in our Art in the City lecture series, co-curated and supported by Aldo Rinaldi, Senior Public Art Officer for Bristol City Council. I'm privileged this evening to welcome Claire Doherty, Director of Situations at UWE and also Curatorial Director of the One Day Sculpture programme, and David Cross, Project Leader and Associate Professor of Fine Arts, Massey University. They're going to give an illustrated presentation on how One Day Sculpture programme has unfolded. And just to let you know that the bookshop will be open after this lecture as well, so please do make your way there. Thank you.
Thanks, Helen. We've got a very particular format to kind of get through because we're dealing with so many individual commissions and we have a finite amount of time. What Claire and I are going to do is do a preamble which kind of unfolds the development of the project. And then we'll launch into a very cursory overview of each of the individual commissions, just factually, so you get a sense of what they were, where they were, etc. And then we'll try and unfold some of what we think are the key ideas in the series towards the end, and of course leaving plenty of time for questions and comments at the end. So that's how we're going to try and play it. And Claire and I will bat back and forth, so we'll be playing tennis down here on the table. Just by way of giving you some context of the series and One Day Sculpture, it began out of the Litmus Research Initiative in New Zealand, which was focusing its very developmental stage for the initiative, and we were attempting to develop some new knowledge around the idea of commissioning in public practice. So we developed a fellowship, and the inaugural fellow was Claire Doherty, who we invited out to New Zealand about 2.5 years ago. And Claire and I discussed the possibility of doing a small, modest research project as a way of testing some of the research ideas that Claire was engaging with. And of course, 2.5 years later, we have this behemoth of a project we're talking to you about tonight called One Day Sculpture. So.
Yeah, I arrived in New Zealand with pretty much this image in my mind, the marketing image of New Zealand as this depopulated, beautiful place. And I was there at the end of 2006, and I spent 3 months there and moved around the country talking to artists and curators and delivering various different lectures. And one of the things that was uppermost in my mind at the time, having initiated Situations in 2003, was thinking about different kinds of models of public art commissioning. And one of the things that became very clear as I discussed this with all the different people that I met was that there was only one, there was a biennial of public art in Christchurch called SCAPE, but other than that, organisations similar to Arnolfini out there didn't commission outside the building. There was very, very little temporary public art commissioning there at all, and there was a strong tradition of permanent public art commissioning, but there was nothing that we know perhaps quite well in Europe and North America. And as I began to talk through these various different models, sculpture projects in Munster, for example, and projects such as Javier Telles's One Flew Over the Void from Insight 05, some of you may remember Javier talking about that here at Arnolfini, Jeremy Deller's Battle of Orgreave, and this project that we commissioned in 2006 by Ivan and Heather Morrison as part of the British Art Show, there seemed to be this huge thirst for really working collaboratively on a project across New Zealand which might involve the commissioning of temporary projects. And this was something that most curators hadn't had the opportunity to do up until that point. And this is curators in artist-run initiatives right the way through to the National Museum. So this fellowship came with a suggestion that I might do some sort of scattered site exhibition project. And out of the conversations that I had with the various different curators, we conceived of a series which would stretch the idea of an exhibition across a year, which instead of being an exhibition which was targeted at an international visitor audience that would fly in for 6 weeks or so, would actually be for residents in New Zealand and would allow for each work, each commission, to occur on its own terms. Now, forgive the rather straightforward teaching mode. But just for those of you who don't know where various different cities are in New Zealand, David, do you want to just go through where the different partners are?
Here's my amateur geography lesson. So there were five cities and regions that we worked with in New Zealand. At the top, you can see Auckland, which is by far the largest city in New Zealand. Has about 30% of the population there. Wellington, which is where Litmus Research Initiative is based, and the majority of projects came out of Wellington, partly because of the partnerships that we developed, but because Litmus engaged with six of the commissions, in South Island, Christchurch, and then Dunedin down in the far south. The other place that we haven't got on the map, but it's probably worth just floating for you, is a region called Taranaki, which is on the west coast of the North Island, just between Wellington and Hamilton, you can see up there. And we had a number of projects that came out of that region.
So the conversations, how this project began, was really in coffee shops and just sort of talking to people about what kind of project we might do. And basically what we did was we recruited every major art institution and every artist-run initiatives in the country, as you can see, it fits on one page, to be involved and to commission a work as part of this series. And that involved various different curators and institutions. And the idea really came from Ivan Heather's project back here in Bristol. I began to talk to people about what would a parameter for each of those commissions be. What could be this connecting tissue, if you like, between all these different temporary commissions? And we came up with this idea, which was that each one would have to occur in its own 24 hours, so on its own day, across over a year. And that each one should be outside of a conventional art space or art building. And that was, although that sort of sounds simplistic, in New Zealand it was really important to say it had to happen outside of a building, but not necessarily outside in the open air. And that was very much about addressing very different audiences. This idea that somehow these projects might be things that you come across unexpectedly. And the third was that the artist commissioned should be given the opportunity to respond to the specific context in which these host organisations were. And the reason for saying that was because I was very keen that this project would give curators the opportunity to invite international artists to New Zealand, and so that it would be a process whereby some of the younger curators and artist-run initiatives would be supported to invite international artists out for the first time. So how that began to form was that we selected jointly with the other curators, there were 13 other curators, a mixture of international and New Zealand-based artists, some really well-known and others just emerging. So it was a real mixture of media, of generation, of approach. And we came up with this title, One Day Sculpture, and that was a way of giving this whole project a frame and an identity that would tie together all the different approaches and commissions. And one thing to say from the outset is it's very important that this began in a university, because this was, in effect, also a research project. And that's not to say that the commissions in themselves were somehow guinea pigs, but that there was this method of inquiry running through the entire project, a critical inquiry, really.
I think one other thing just to add in terms of the day itself is that not all the projects took place over 24 hours, but they happened on their own discrete day. So it needed to have its own day. Some projects lasted for 4 hours, others lasted for the full 24. So you'll see when we go through the images that some of these projects were literally running for that whole duration, and they played with that idea of duration. Others were much more just on that day itself for a reduced duration of time.
Now, one of the things to say is that if you can imagine, this was a project that began with no money. There was nothing on the table, and there was no identity at all. So this creating this brand for the project was a very important part. And David and I will tell you a little bit more later about how that brand became quite dominant and how it's now taking a back seat, if you like, now that we have the projects. But I think that was very important to begin. If you can imagine, there was nothing. There was no website. There was no idea that this project had begun. So we had to get the word out there. And one of the ways of doing that, at the launch, the press launch of when the artists were announced, before any of the projects began, was that we staged a project that we felt encapsulated some of the ideas we were quite interested in to explore. And that was Roman Ondak's Good Feelings and Good Times, which, for those of you who may not have seen this project before, it's a queue of people that forms inexplicably, for no reason, for about 7 minutes in various locations across a city or a particular location. It was first staged in Vienna and then again at Fries Art Fair, and then it was bought by the Tate. So we had this piece on loan in New Zealand. And as you can see, in New Zealand, queues aren't very regular.
We don't queue.
There aren't enough people. So it was a really interesting case of a recontextualised work, which operated to enable, I think, the press and audiences in New Zealand, particularly in Wellington, to begin to think about what a one-day sculpture might be and how notions of performance, of the temporal, might then begin to be considered along with a public artwork. How was this a public artwork? How is it a sculptural form, a body of people, if you like? And another really important component at the beginning was setting up this website that acted also as a research resource. Because we didn't have a building or a hub of information, this was the place where you go and find out about when work's occurring. And staging Roman's work right at the beginning, not as a commission but as a restaging of a work, was also really helpful in thinking through, for example, this was a work that needed to occur unexpectedly without revealing its location. So we began to tease out how to do that and how to alert audiences that these works might not tell you where they were going to be and how we could unfold that, as well as things like an online reading, podcasts, all those sorts of things that would just build around the project's extra information for people who were interested, partly because none of the works were accompanied by signage or interpretation of any sort. Okay.
So, should we go into the...
Yeah. So what we're going to do now is run you very quickly through the chronology of projects, and we're going to be quite factual so that we can then get to a point where there are a number of key ideas that run across some of the works. So we'll run you through so you get a really good sense of the chronology of the projects, and in your handout it sort of tells you the dates. And then we'll come back to the projects and start to extrapolate them a little bit more. So the first project occurred on August the 28th last year, and it was by New Zealander Maddie Leach, and it involved the announcement in newspaper in days prior to the project that Wellington's worst storm was about to happen. And she used the long-range weather forecasting technique to predict the worst possible storm. And what she did was that she refurbished a boat shed on Wellington's outermost harbour point. And inside the boat shed, she installed this window from which to view the oncoming storm. So it was part shelter, part platform. It was kind of an adjusted ready-made of sorts, a meeting point, if you like, for this inclement weather. But of course, it turned out to be Wellington's most beautiful winter day that could be imagined. And so it had this very peculiar quality of waiting for something that never came. Okay, we're going to switch on.
This is the second project by two emerging New Zealand artists, Kate Newby and Nick Austin. It was in a Central Park in Auckland, and it's a major thoroughfare for people walking their dogs on Saturdays and Sundays. And it consisted of a binocular on that pad that you can see there that you look through, and through the telescope you could see in the distance, clear, just flick back again for me, you could see that image, which was a seagull on top of a newspaper. And the experience of the work was such that you could walk between the platform and head down to actually see this seagull. There was also, peripherally to the right, another seagull that was placed on a different bench about 150 metres away. So you could see that through the naked eye, but you could look through the telescope and see that seagull. So the work had this intensely uncanny quality about an intervention into the past.
And they're two quite young artists that were quite playful in terms of these... well, in that case, two stuffed birds, but these kind of playful of these quite subtle pieces and objects throughout the park. So it was very much a piece that was, it was quite, it's sort of quite slight and quite subtle in certain ways, wasn't it?
They were also playing, just very quickly, but they were playing with the idea of colonisation of this park, because this, in this particular park in Auckland, every single tree is an introduced species. So they were interested in the idea of using these seagulls as a sort of a mode or metaphor, if you like, to deal with the notion of gardens and colonisation, those kinds of things. Okay, this is Kabi Chow, who's again another young emerging New Zealand artist. She wanted to work quite specifically with the history of place in Wellington. This part of Wellington is where the old Chinese, or the Chinatown was in Wellington. There's no evidence at all of that Chinatown now. And she picked up on the history and story of a Chinese man that was murdered in a race-based murder in the early part of the 20th century for no other reason than he was Chinese. So she established a garden in his memory and created a soup kitchen. And the soup kitchen was also connected to the fact that next door to this particular site there was a real soup kitchen. And the work played and examined the idea of a lost history within New Zealand and introduced a whole range of people that had some connection to the Chinatown in the 50s, 60s and 70s and interviewed them and showed those interviews on those monitors. So you can see there people watching these interviews. And you could, of course, have soup as well. This is the work of Amy Howden Chapman. This was a very interesting project engaging with the urban fabric of Wellington. Now, Wellington's quite a small city. It's a tight little compact city. And the work was picking up on ideas surrounding the history of the waterfront area of Wellington and the reclaimed land. And she mapped out a series of bells across about a 2 or 3 kilometre stretch through Wellington, which marked out the line where the city had been reclaimed and building had been built on it. And a number of runners ran through the city ringing these bells at regular intervals across the whole sweep. So one would ring the bell, they'd run to the next and run to the next. So for 2 hours we had this very strange atmospheric ringing of bells across Wellington.
Should I do this? Liz Allen, it was quite interesting how it began to unfold in terms of which artists started to appear in the cluster, because what we found was that there was a cluster of quite young emerging artists at the beginning, which was quite tough in some ways because we wanted to give those artists the opportunity to try things out they hadn't done before, and it meant that some of the international, perhaps more mature artists came a little later. So this beginning, I would say, would you agree with this? This cluster at the beginning was quite tough for those young artists because it was quite a high profile project for them. But I think this is one artist who really came into her own. Her name's Liz Allen, and she worked with an independent curator called Melanie Oliver to stage a festival in a small town in Taranaki in memory of this writer called Ronald Hugh Morrison, who's a sort of infamous figure in that town. He was a drunkard. He was a he's kind of, there's a kind of
he was kind of like a beatnik in the 60s.
And his books, like The Scarecrow, were made into films in New Zealand. And the place of where his house was originally has now got a Kentucky Fried Chicken built over the top of it. And there's this single memorial to him in Kentucky Fried Chicken. So a series, Liz orchestrated this day. She took her one-day sculpture to be a day of commemoration, a festival for him in the town. And in a very interesting way, kind of dealt with being the outsider and dealing with the various residents of that town. And I think what was so interesting about how it unfolded was that she took that notion of the day as a commemorative gesture, an anniversary, if you like, and turned it into a festival which was quite strident and quite tense at moments. So there were various readings from Ronald Hugh Morrison's books in the Kentucky Fried Chicken. So you had this kind of weird thing going on with people who come in to have their, your bucket of chicken fingers or whatever, and other kind of art world people from Wellington and Auckland. And so it was kind of this really interesting, you were there, really interesting kind of tension. And then various things happened throughout the day that involved various different kinds of degrees of participation from the town's residents. Subsequent to that, there was the first of the international artists. And it was interesting after all of those quite I would say participatory projects, those that kind of, some really quite subtle, like Amy's. This was probably the project which was most iconic for the series, which was a barricade by the artists Ivan and Heather Morrison, who were responsible for the work here. And Ivan and Heather went through a number of different proposals before arriving at what they wanted to do, which was to barricade an entire road in Wellington for the duration of a Sunday. And this is quite a busy street in the middle of Wellington. And it involved the construction of this remarkable sculptural object, this barricade, which had something in the region of 20 buses in it and involved rubbish from all around and recycled material from the dump. Very much their idea began with J.G. Ballard's Drowned World and this vivid image in the middle of Drowned World in which he describes the protagonists coming across a square in which the detritus is moved back and it's revealed that it's Trafalgar Square and there's this kind of dystopian future that's revealed. And this work had that kind of quality to it. It had a quality that something had gone awry. Was it a landslip? Was it a political barricade in some ways? And it was constructed overnight and deinstalled overnight. So it was up from visible from as this from about 8 in the morning until about 8 at night. Do you want to say some more about that? This was the view from the other side, so it had quite different kind of qualities to each side.
Okay, this is a project that happened just before Christmas last year in Dunedin. Now, Dunedin's quite a far south city. It's Scottish, has a Scottish sort of ancestry and history to it. And the artists that were involved were four artists in this project called Intertidal. Two of them were British artists, Walker and Bromwich, and the other two were New Zealanders. It was quite an ambitious project by a young artist-run space in Dunedin. And in the end, the artists were going to work together, but they decided ultimately that they would work into two groups. So the New Zealand artists did a project here, which you can see, where they were interested in the idea of engaging with the history of the site, which is called Quarantine Island. And it was literally a quarantine island in the middle of Dunedin Harbour, where during the 19th century, boats that came in and anyone who was sick was placed onto the island. So it's got this incredible Gothic quality to it. And the two of the artists decided that they wanted to pick up on that idea of the contagious aspect of the history of the site by examining the idea of seaweed. So they did a seaweed hunt, where the audience was encouraged to go across that foreshore area there and try and find seaweed, where they actually had somebody on the day actually identifying that seaweed. And they found what they were interested in doing was see if they could find new seaweed that hadn't been found before. And they did manage to find two species that had not been identified. So the area here is right where the ships are coming past. So it's a lot about international travel and that kind of dialogue. And the second component, completely different project by Walker and Bromwich, involved this rather strange-looking spider suit outfit. This was a cave, a really interesting cave that they'd found on the island. And small groups of people were ushered into the cave, and Zoe, dressed up in the spider suit, recounted the story of Robert the Bruce and what happened to him in the cave, etc. And then she asked each audience member to recount their own epiphany. So this work was about epiphanies, was also about that history of the Scottish context in Dunedin. So there's a few different things going on. Now, this one thing that I really need to frame for One Day Sculpture is the weather. We haven't talked about the weather, but we are an outrageously weather-dependent series. Now, Wellington in particular, as a city, is the windiest city in the world, and it means that when you're making temporary public sculptures, you are running the gauntlet. Of course, there is a perversity to the weather in that when Maddie Leach wanted to have incredibly terrible weather, she got a wonderful day. Bedawa Williams's project, on the other hand, had the biblical fury weather that Wellington can occasionally turn on. Very quickly, just to give you a context of the work, it was the Welsh Man's 24-hour rally, where, dressed up as a sort of Rembrandt clone, Bedawa Williams drove around in his rally car and did a painting of various sites across Wellington each hour for 24 hours. Now, this was about 2 hours before he looked like he was going to die, because really, by the end of it, it was unbelievably torturous. It was like 70s duration extremity performance art rolled in. But he completed the 24 paintings, he dried them off, he showed them in the gallery, and it was a very interesting, if torturous, engagement with that idea of duration, of course, 24 hours.
I think particularly in regard in that piece, I think you've written quite beautifully about it on the website, which is that there were these. It was a performative piece, and obviously, and clearly he was dressed up as the artist and kind of playing with this perverse notion of it being a one-day sculpture and producing 24 paintings, and you know, in his kind of ironic way. But that there were these moments in which, for example, he met the head of the Welsh Historical Society in Wellington, and she kind of beckoned him into her house, and there were these kind of moments of dialogic sort of exchange, which I think were quite beautiful, and in terms of how that he as the artist took on that role, that kind of durational marathon really. Mm. And he undertook that at the end and had champagne at midnight, and this was quite interesting, this project, because this is where two projects abutted in the same city, which was one of the only times that happened. Mm. And you had midnight, 11:59, Bedwa's project finishing, and midnight, Lara Almerzegi's project starting. So there's this kind of handover between the two artists, which was quite interesting.
Now, again, this project by Lara Almerzegi, she's a Spanish artist. She came out and did quite an extensive research visit, which was excellent, and she found an absolute compelling interest in the fact that in New Zealand we move houses around. So quite often people will buy a house somewhere and they'll move it to a different part of New Zealand, which she found incredibly compelling as an area of investigation, because it follows on from lots of her research interests around sites and non-sites, wastelands, etc. So she decided that she would work with this yard in Wellington called Britain's House Moving Yard, where they've constructed a kind of almost quasi-suburban street of houses for sale that you can buy to move. What Lara was really interested in was the researching the history of these houses. And whilst she was interested in them as objects, as entities, she was fundamentally more interested in tracing the history of these houses and publish them in newspaper form. So hence, on the day of the work itself, there was a full two-page spread in the local Wellington newspaper that outlined a history of each one of the houses in what she called Britain Street. And those histories were incredibly interesting, right from 19th century early settlers into Wellington, right through to 1980s terrible prefab housing and the history of these. So it was a very interesting unfolding of a kind of complex social history around the notion of housing and its temporary stature, standing.
And the project involved that evening of the project a tour by her of the houses. And what was interesting is people read the paper during the day and arrived with pictures of themselves in front of their house as a child. So it, and we'll come on to that in the sense, but it was very much one of those projects that reached a very different audience and created this temporary community of people who had no reason to meet other than the fact that their houses happened to be next to each other in this house moving yard. So it was really kind of curious, wasn't it? Becca Curran, another fairly young artist, New Zealander, and for me, this was one of our commissions. Really interesting to work with a young artist and to do something that she'd never done before. She'd never worked in a public context before. And she created this annex to the National Library, which is in Wellington, which included a fictional archive of utopian images. So it was almost like coming across a rather strange, anonymous collection of images of rainbows and sunsets and people relaxing. And it was called I Remember Golden Light, and very much created this rather strange atmosphere of coming across somebody's collection or archive. And there's a wonderful anecdote I'll just tell you very quickly about this, which is that on the evening of the opening, she'd been invited to drinks with the director of the National Library, and she went into the front entrance and said to the receptionist there, you know, I need to go and meet the director for drinks. And they let her through and sent her through to somewhere else, and they said, oh, you need to go to this new the new building, the new annex of the library. And she said, okay, and they gave her directions, and she walked up around the stairs, around the back of the building, and it brought her right out at the front, right in front of her work. So it had already been assimilated into the library as this kind of annex. But she talked very much about this idea of it being an appendage somehow to the library. And the outside of it is created through a series of lever arch files. So it has had this kind of quality that any moment it could implode itself or kind of fade away in some ways.
The building's a very iconic modernist building in New Zealand, and she played with that idea of modernism with her folders. So the actual structure had this quirky, whacked-out version of modernism. But one other thing, just before we move on, is that the National Library is currently being renovated. And so there was an interesting tension right through this project around the National Library being concerned that this work was in some ways a critique of the fact that they're actually, in a sense, gutting that building and turning it into a far more postmodern-like structure. And so Becker's work, in a sense, also was happening at a time of major change to the building. So that added this really interesting dimension to the work. Okay, this is Thomas Hirshhorn's commission, Poor Racer, and this is in Christchurch in the South Island. It's very much as it appears. It's a classic Thomas Hirshhorn customization of a boy racer car. Now, the boy racer culture in Christchurch, for whatever reason, Christchurch is one of the great cities in the world for boy racer culture. And this particular location is a beachside suburb called Sumner, which every Friday and Saturday night, it's just sort of Revhead City as cars go up and down and up and down. Now, when Thomas came...
Revhead City.
I've
heard that before.
And so he worked with a number of people to customise a classic New Zealand version of the kind of boy racer car and placed it on its own quasi-plinth right on this sort of key stretch of Sumner Beach. And it ran for the full 24 hours, so it began at midnight, finished at midnight. And this is Thomas's favourite shot. He loves this photograph, which is the sort of one of the boy racer girls coming out and kind of prodding around a little bit and sniffing it out. And I think she turned to him and said, yeah, it's not bad, this car. And then she got back in her car and disappeared. So there's a lovely inflection, too, with the way that this work activated a range of communities, not only the Sumner community, but the boy racer community. We've got another shot that we'll show you in a moment, which is a series of Corvette cars that came and backed up. Oh, there it is there. So an interesting way of engaging with this idea of community in Christchurch.
Now, there was a cluster of projects, international projects, around the symposium, which was held at the end of March. This was one of the first, which was Paolo Pivi, which involved the flying of 80 goldfish across the ocean on their own chartered jet. And in line with Paolo's previous work, this work was commissioned by Auckland Art Gallery for the Auckland Festival, and always involves this kind of wonderful imaginative step, often involving animals of some kind. And they were flown in their own on their own seats, in their own goldfish bowls. And it was quite interesting, this particular project, because a number of the projects, the artists used the one-day sculpture projects to make films. And this involved the filming of a 16mm film in the air. So the public nature of this project was quite different, and the film will come later. And we'll talk a little bit more about that later on. But the public aspect of this was quite elite, and there was a whole atmosphere around this particular project, which was very much sort of a kind of quite exclusive kind of project in some ways, which was antithetical to Javier Telles's project, which we'll mention in a second. 100 people were invited to this aircraft hangar in outside Auckland City, and invited to step onto the plane and see these goldfish after their flight, followed by canapes and champagne. So it was quite a sort of rarefied experience in terms of the publicness of the work. Whereas Javier Telles's project, Intermission, was entirely different. This involved the bringing of two live lions to a 1920s cinema in a small town called Opanaki in the Taranaki region. And the entire town turned out and queued to see the lions and were let into the cinema. And the whole thing was set up so it was very much a sense of you were in a cage and the lions were walking around you. So it was quite filmic. It was almost like a film set, very consciously so. The seating was taken out of the ground floor of the cinema, and just 20 seats left, around which was this high-level fencing. And about 20, 25 people went in, didn't they, for a period of about 10 minutes. And the lions were let in, and the MGM lion came up and roared, and often the lions roared back. And there was an incredible feeling of tension, obviously, and it was an extraordinary spectacle. But equally, there was all these different kind of sight lines that you were being viewed and you were viewing. So I felt when I went in that what was genius, really, on Javier's part was that he hadn't created a single fence so that there'd be a border between you and the lions, but in fact, instead, you were surrounded, so they walked around you. And what was absolutely extraordinary was how this story had spread across that small town, and that what it allowed you to do was to talk to people about your experience of seeing these lions in the cinema, as opposed to whether you were an insider or an outsider. It brought people together in a very interesting way.
There was one other dimension to that work, just before we leave it.
Yeah.
Is that at the very beginning, when you came in, suddenly an usher, who was the oldest usher in New Zealand, asked everybody to stand up, at which point they played on the screen an image of God Save the King, and you were supposed to sort of do this while it happened, and then when that finished you sat down and then the lions came in. So it did pay homage to a very particular history of cinema going in New Zealand.
Yeah. Roman Ondak's work was entirely different, a very quiet, subtle intervention. This is the largest wooden building in the southern hemisphere. It was government offices and is now used by the Department of Law. And it is wooden, built to resemble a stone Italianate building. And Roman's intervention, if you can just see, I haven't got one on our historical pointer, but there's a small pile of sawdust right at the bottom of the left-hand side of the window. And there were 8 piles of sawdust that were spread around. Sorry, let's see that one. Oh, yes, there we go. The building, as if it was slowly crumbling. And this lovely, subtle intervention was this very strange sense of drawing attention to the woodenness of the building, but also it is a seat of power and its slow ebbing away of the power. But as a one-day sculpture, it was interesting because of the ways in which it caused the audience to go looking for it, and it's something we'll come on to in a minute, in terms of Jan Verwerth talked about this at the conference as being of kind of denying that expectation or desire to be fulfilled when you reach the destination, and causing many people to say, is that it? So we'll talk about that in a minute.
Okay, so this is the work of Billy Apple, who is a very well-regarded senior artist in New Zealand who spent a lot of time in New York in the 60s and 70s, used to show with Leo Castelli. Returned to New Zealand in the 80s, and he has a very particular conceptual practice, a strong emphasis on using text to activate a range of issues around artist rights. And this particular work is a really interesting one because it links together a very well-known conceptual artist activating and engaging with a history of an organicist sculptor, Henry Moore. And this is really a piece that engages with the history of this work in Wellington, which is a piece by Henry Moore in the Botanical Gardens, which has not been, according to Billy Apple, well looked after, or it hasn't been looked after in the terms that Henry Moore would like it to have been looked after. So he's staged this kind of intervention into the gardens, calling for the Wellington City Council to remove the lacquer and the wax from this object, which has been added, so that the object can grace as it should have been able to have been developed. So what's nice about this work in particular is it's the interventionist politics which is really prefaced in the work, but the way in which it's also responding to the history of an object in Wellington and the way in which it's been or hasn't been looked after, according to Billy Apple. So the work consists, as you can see, of this large billboard which was parked next to the sculpture for the course of 24 hours, and people came into the Botanical Gardens to enjoy this kind of quite interesting yet convivial intervention in terms of the billboard and the object.
And what we'll show you in a minute is that the billboard included a copy of an original letter by Henry Moore, which declared his desires for the patina on his sculptures.
Okay. Now we're getting to much more recent projects now, which are quite fresh in the mind. This is Bic van der Pol's project, 1440 Minutes Towards the Development of a Site. This is a really interesting project because it's extremely subtle in its orientation. It consists of them taking a site in Auckland that had a very particular history of political activism through the 60s and 70s and building what they call a free site. So they constructed a space in which people could act or be or engage in political issues as they chose. But it didn't really exist beyond that premise, with the exception that there was a newspaper that had been published by the local art school students that was an attempt for them to think through ideas of politics and contemporary practice, which was worked in conjunction with Vic van der Poel. So the work happened for 24 hours in a bandstand, and interestingly, the politics was reasonably negligible. So in a sense, the work revealed a certain level of apathy and indifference to certain kinds of politics, which, yeah, in a sense, was a kind of anticlimax, but perhaps again, when you're creating a space in which things can happen, then that has to be the byproduct of the parameters. This is James Luna, American Indian artist, did a project with Te Papa in Wellington, where he staged a performance. It was supposed to originally have been outside, but because of a variety of reasons to do with weather, it was actually staged inside Te Papa itself. But he worked with a local community of performers, and so he told stories about his ancestral history, histories of Native American culture, and then mixed it in with this incredible kind of weird sense of a freak show of performers, a woman on stilts talking about 15th century art history, people coming in and doing strange mixing gigs. And so it was a very interesting, impure engagement with notions of indigeneity and the Wellington community of performers that he kind of came across. So it was sort of a travelling show, had this travelling show quality, but he at the same time was very interested in activating and engaging with Māori culture or New Zealand Indigenous culture. So I think it's an important project in our series because of the specificity of New Zealand having a bicultural heritage, and that James Luna was somebody who really wanted to engage with the Māori history of New Zealand.
The final three projects, two of which were produced by ArtSpace in Auckland. ArtSpace is probably equivalent to, it's like a sort of small Arnolfini, really, primarily just exhibitions. And they produced a project by Rick Ritter-Vanija, which involved the mailing of a card. And that was a particularly difficult project at the beginning for us to get our heads around of how this constituted a one-day sculpture project, because quite cleverly Rick Ritt played with the parameters of the curatorial parameters, and that's partly why we decided to have the project towards the end, where the curatorial parameters would have been understood by them by a general public. This card, this image, was sent out on a card on which was the exact replica of all the other announcement cards. And instead of the date of the project, it just had today and then the title, Pay Attention. And the idea was to, in effect, to draw attention to these very strange sculptural forms in the New Zealand landscape, which are two-dimensional representations of the traffic beacons. So if you won't be able to see, but these traffic beacons aren't three-dimensional round, they're flat. They're flat circles. So in essence, they are already sculptural in some ways. And I think that Rick Ritt was particularly interested to have this idea that a card might land on your doormat, and that you would not know exactly when the project was taking place, but you might suddenly start to notice these things. And that, in effect, is the project in the tradition of mail art, if you like, that it becomes dispersed and circulates in other ways. It becomes activated when you see this image rather than on the day that the artist says the project is going to occur. Superflex produced a wonderful project in Auckland with the ANZ Bank, and the staff of the bank were contracted for banking hours not to use the word dollars. And so for that entire day, those 9 hours, they had to use another word, and if they used the word dollars, they had to pay a fine into their social fund. So this is the bank manager signing the contract, the Superflex contract, and it's part of the Superflex series entitled Contract, in which they are interested in these small interventions within the economic system which can fundamentally change. And so this is this rather coy bank employee trying desperately not to say the word dollars. When confronted, this is an art critic, John Hurrell, who's desperately trying to make her say the word dollars. So it was also quite interesting in that this is it's on the K Road in Auckland, which is it's quite a kind of freaky, kind of bohemian kind of street. And so you had all these different characters coming to the bank and all these art visitors coming to the bank in attempting to engage with the work as well. So it was quite an interesting...
There was a really interesting tension in the work as well between the bank, who saw this project as something to celebrate. So when we walked through the door first in the morning, they put streamers and balloons out, like this was like art day. So there was that very, very surreal dimension where everyone was kind of like, rah, rah, this is so much fun, and, oh, I said the word dollars, you know, that kind of thing. And this incredibly interesting but dexterous political critique of globalisation that sort of unfolds somewhere in the Superflex project. So it was like this collision of two different languages, as Claire articulated, in a very particular bank, in a quite a sort of rundown part of Auckland.
And this was our final project, which was by the artist Michael Parakorfai, who we worked with to produce this sign, neon sign, which says the word open, which is mounted on the back of a Hiab truck. Now, it's important to know that this kind of neon signage is really incongruous in Wellington. It's just not really seen. You don't really have that kind of neon signage. And what he decided to do was that he wanted to recontextualise this sign in lots of different locations throughout the day. So it began at the Inter-Islander ferry terminal, parked just as the ferries come in the darkness at 5 a.m, and you could see it coming off the motorway, and then was relocated throughout the day and ended up on the top of Mount Victoria, the highest point in Wellington, which you could see for miles. And you had a great moment when two people drove from the other side of the bay to come and see.
Yeah, one of the last sites of the work was a very isolated peninsula, and there was no one around for miles and miles. And that peninsula actually had ferries going past, so people on the ferries could see this flashing sign. That was also right next to the airport, where planes taking off would see this flashing sign. But there was no one around at all, except this car came speeding up, pulled on the anchors, and they ran out, and they'd seen the sign from about 15 kilometres away and wondered what the hell it was. So they jumped in the car, it was really cold, and they drove all the way across the peninsula just to find out what it was. And when we told them it was an artwork, they said, oh, that's great, fantastic. Got back in the car, drove back.
But it's quite, I think the important thing also is that it's made from scratch, so it's not a ready-made, it's beautifully made and sprayed, and it's Michael's work is has that kind of high production values to it. It's quite kitschy. It's a little bit of Vegas in maybe in Wellington for that time. But he conceived it very much as the last project in the series, and he talked about this work being a question mark that hangs off the end of the series. So this idea of rather something concluding a series, saying effectively what is to come, how open have we been to this type of work and these very different types of approaches that have gone through the entire series. So that is kind of like rattling you through all the different 20 projects. The one project we haven't mentioned is by Santiago Sierra. This might be interesting to unfold a little bit more in questions, but Santiago was invited by St. Paul Street Gallery in Auckland to do a project, and he came out on his research visit whilst we were there. Unfortunately, the curator at St. Paul Street Gallery left him rather in the lurch, and we undertook to look after Santiago during his research visit. And he decided he didn't want to produce a one-day sculpture project nor to be included in the book, but staged his own guerrilla action, as we called it, during the symposium. And that involved inviting people to a location, inviting the audience from the symposium to a location where we queued up and were allowed one person at a time into a room where a man was standing with his penis hanging out. And that was Santiago's action. Now, there's been some really interesting conversations which we're happy to take up afterwards in terms of whether or not that constituted a one-day sculpture project, and also what do you do when things go awry with artists commissioning projects such as that, particularly as it wasn't our commissioned artist as curatorial directors of the series. So we can talk a little bit more about that in the questions, maybe.
Okay, well, we thought that'd take us 10 minutes, and about an hour later we've got to the end of the series. And in the time that we've got left, what we'd like to try and do is maybe talk about what we think are the kind of key ideas that have begun to kind of filter across the series, of which there's four that we'll talk to and try and link it back into some of the images that we haven't shown you. And the four key ideas that we've sort of distilled, I guess, in the last year, firstly, the idea of temporary communities, the dispersal of site, narrative interruption and materiality. So I'll just begin by talking a little bit about this idea of temporary communities. I think that it's by its very nature, when you do a project with a parameter around 24 hours, it's going to build in a certain notion of performativity and community. And that's largely because you're getting large numbers of people engaging with the work because it's only there for a short period of time. So I think this idea of temporary communities has become really interesting. And there's a couple of dimensions to that. One, it is the idea of the locale and how that inflected. For example, in Javier's work in Opanaki, the entire town came out to see the work because it was like people heard that there were going to be lions in town. So suddenly everybody gets on the telephone and goes, this thing's happening, we're going to get down there. And so the project actually really activated the whole community, not just a sort of art community. This is an image you can't really but laugh about. And this is Liz Allen's project, a different image that you wouldn't have seen that we've shown you so far. This is in Hawera, which is about 100 kilometres away from Opanaki. But again, we're talking the rural heartland of New Zealand, which is really a sheep farming town. And this is the festival for Ronald Hugh Morrison. One of the components of Liz's project was a big event in the town centre itself, where she had bands playing, and then she had competitions. And these two guys here entered into a competition Liz had, which was a scarecrow look-alike competition. Scarecrow was a book by Ronald Hugh Morrison. Now, my daughter, who's about the same age as that, turned up with all her gear, took one side of these guys and exited stage left. She wasn't going to go on the scarecrow competition with these two guys. So there was an interesting sense of bringing, again, activating and inflecting the work with very specific kinds of communities across the whole spread of the community, not just within an art context.
I think there's a, you know, all of us are much more careful about the use of the term community now and what we mean by it. And actually what we discovered through a lot of the projects is that that communities are formed, a community of interest around a project, and that stories are generated through that project. So what you find is it's through your experience of working with people over a long period of time, or perhaps coming to a particular place for a single day, you become part of a community of interest in that project, as opposed to it being a community project. And I think that became quite clear through some of the more sophisticated processes of research. And equally with Lara's work, the way in which that gathered that community of people who had lived in those houses and had that experience was really interesting.
But I was going to say, the beautiful story that comes from this work was that a woman turned up with a photograph of herself, and she'd actually seen the work in the newspaper that day, and she grew up in one of the houses, and she brought along photographs of her and her sister living in that house. Mm. And then recounted these stories. It was like an incredible shift in terms of the way the work played out.
And but also the way in which we worked with the artist was that it was really interesting to watch Lara's research process develop, because actually, if you ever have the chance to read the newspaper, and it's the PDF is online on the website, the histories are really factual. You know, they're not in any way nostalgic. They're not. They don't indulge in a nostalgic of the history of those houses. They're quite factual, and so there's all this emotion and social history underlining that. But somehow the integrity of the project holds because really the histories of the houses are really quite factual within that piece, aren't they?
Yeah.
Shall I go on? The other really interesting thing that occurred, we felt, was this question of calling people to a destination. Now, there were some works which were literally dispersed, like Rickert's project, for example, that you couldn't find where the work was necessarily. But also, what emerged was the calling of people to a destination to then find that the site of the work wasn't there. So, for example, and I'm thinking very much in sort of Robert Smithson's terms, this notion that he says that once you get there, there's no destination. The site is evading you all the while it's directing you to it. So one of the things that came out of One Day Sculpture was very much an idea of what is site, what is a site or a situation, is it evasive? And so in Maddie Leach's project, this calling of the audience to a place in which to witness this storm that never came. And in Lara's project, this calling to a house mover's yard, where the houses somehow then stood in for all the places that were dispersed over Wellington from which they came. So in a sense, they became kind of metaphors for all these other places. So whilst you were standing in the House Movers Yard, you weren't talking about the House Movers Yard, you were talking about the street down the road or the foreshore, etc. And equally, the Bagnall, Hyde, Walker and Bromwich piece, that sense of that travelling, taking you to Quarantine Island and then taking you on another set of stories and ideas. And even Michael Parakorfai's project, that idea of directing you that somewhere is open, but this disembodied sign somehow being from elsewhere or marking out a place in a different way. This is the sign at the Inter-Island Ferry Terminal at about 5 a.m. And then this idea of narrative was also really interesting. It's very much something that came up in the Morrison's work when it was here in Bristol. This idea of creating these works, because they operate like events, and we tried wherever possible not to use the word event with these projects because we wanted them to have integrity as artworks, not simply as spectacles to be consumed, if you like. But they did instill in the cities or the places where they were a series of new myths and stories. So, for example, very much this the Morrison's Barricade operated on those terms. And people, because what we were careful to do was to not put up signage, but we had stewards who were quite sort of informal, who were informed about the work, talked to people about the work. There was a sense in which people would say something like, oh, is it for a film? Or, oh, yeah, I think it's part of that disaster film, isn't it? So they'd immediately tried to find a narrative into which the work could be placed. And there's lovely things like, for example, well, what's left behind? And it was a question that was asked to me this week, actually, by a journalist in Bristol, of how can you justify temporary projects, the cost of temporary projects? And I was saying to him, well, just because something's not there, it doesn't mean that it doesn't reside in your memory. And I think that this is the only... I sort of made a pilgrimage to the site of this work because I couldn't be there for it. And this is what's left. There's a scratch on the ground and a little bit of rubbish, and that's it. And so there's this sense in which there isn't a material presence of that work, but it again, it resides in memory. The same with Amy's work, in that was quite interesting how it operated as the only sound work, if you like, in the series. And equally, the way in which Javier Tellez's work operates forevermore in Opanaki as the day the lions came to town, and that kind of memory of it. And Paola's clearly works as this imaginative leap of imagining these goldfish flying across the ocean. And one of the other key ideas that emerged was this idea of interruption. I think the great advantage of staging a series of projects, each of which only lasts for 24 hours, is you can get away with quite a lot. So to barricade a street for a day, somehow the council agreed. But also it allows the work to operate on its own terms for quite a short period of time. And I think this notion of interruption is something very interesting that we want to continue working with at Situations, which is works which somehow rupture our everyday goings-on or our notion of what is familiar. So this large wooden building that everyone takes for granted within Wellington and perhaps don't even know that it's made of wood, again, attention is drawn to it in the same way as Rick Ritt's project, attention is drawn. And in the same way, this intervention calling for action to restore the Moor, the Henry Moor, operates as that kind of a rupture within Wellington's history. And finally, Superflex's very clever intervention within the economic system and how that might have had effects that we don't yet know of. Dollars, the word dollars was also not allowed to be written in any form, in any communication by the bank staff during that day. So who knows? New Zealand's economy might fall as a result.
I think that, as you've already picked up, there's a huge discursive sense of materiality in the projects. And it's kind of easy at times to forget that we're actually dealing with the idea of temporary public sculpture. And so clearly what has been really interesting was the way in which artists navigated this notion of materiality and pushed and prodded with it. And some of the work, such as Ivan and Heather's Journey to Barricade, was definitively sculptural. It had a very strong sculptural presence. It had formal qualities to it. It was very much within a kind of trajectory of sculpture that we can grasp within perhaps more conventional senses of what sculpture is. But at the same time, we have something like Maddie Leach's project, which is also dealing with materiality, but she's playing, in a sense, with other ideas, found ideas around sort of Duchampian aspects, mixed in, again, with this kind of use of this cedar material, which made the thing smell like it was a sauna. So it was a kind of careful, probably an altered ready-made, if you like, but at the same time, prefacing the idea of the spatial and the material in the work. Even the Seagull work in Auckland, again, where the artists are, again, trying to push and prod with the idea of this notion of materiality and where objectness sits in relationship to formativity and participation and the idea of place. This work, again, by Becca Caron, which we talked about before, has an overtly sculptural quality because of the handling of these folders. I mean, the idea of the work was that you flick through the folder, you find images, you look at them. But it's an immensely sculptural experience, but the idea of the haptic carefully prefaced in the work rather than just the visual. And poor old Bedewa Williams, who had just about drowned at the stage. What I found interesting about this idea of materiality was, again, the nexus between painting and sculpture and the way in which these objects were in their own right the 24-hour sculpture, or they were the one-day sculpture. Of course, it was mixed with performance and the idea of the ordeal, but it was so intensely sculptural. Claire, you finish with this one.
Yeah, like, I think maybe we can unfold this a bit more in questions, but one of the most fantastic things for me was the experience of talking to all those artists and curators about their response to these curatorial parameters, which were effectively quite tight, you know, quite strict in some ways, but also quite open, quite flexible. So someone like Michael Parakofai, who's here with his piece, absolutely undertook and was inspired and interested in the parameters and wanted very much this to be the last piece. But clearly, in terms of materiality, in terms of temporary sculpture, I think offered particularly the City Council, who part paid for this work in particular, the opportunity to rethink the potential for public sculpture in Wellington as opposed to permanent, permanently sited pieces. And it felt like a kind of fitting end to the series. One of the things that, as you can imagine, is very strange for us is that no one apart from David saw all of the works. David and the photographer, Steve Rowe. So we had a single photographer taking all the shots of the whole series. So it was quite unusual for people to see them all at once. And that will happen in the book, which will be produced now in November, with all the details. So you can also see them all on the website. But if you can imagine, these works very much occurred on their own terms. And that was quite an interesting thing that we wanted to see, whether it would work, that effectively you could commission works that would be a part of an entire series and have dialogue with each other. But equally, you could experience one and have get as much out of it as if you saw them all. So it was a very different kind of curatorial initiative than a kind of biennial exhibition in which you consume everything at once or attempt to.
Just before we open up to questions, I think one thing that Claire and I were really keen to kind of have a dialogue about are the things that went wrong, the mistakes, the problems, the issues that sit in the series, because you could probably look at this and see this as some kind of seamless continuum, but there were projects that were less successful than others, and there were methods and ways of engaging with these projects that we would rethink. Mm. And I think that it's like herding cats when you work with 13 curators. And there is a huge level of complexity in terms of trying to create a coherence for the series whilst at the same time respecting the agency of the curator to make decisions as to what they want to do. And I think that even though we are really delighted with the overall sense of the project, I think that there are certainly issues around ideas of communication, levels of support. We work with some younger curators, and I think at times we sometimes think that maybe those curators were actually able to kind of realise the projects, but on another level they weren't up front perhaps sometimes in seeking some counsel from either of us. So I think that there were projects that needed a little bit more finessing, needed a little bit more critical thinking through, and perhaps maybe relied on chance a little bit too much in terms of what was going to happen across the course of the day.
So, any questions or thoughts?
I was really amazed by your final selection of four themes that you chose. I do 24-hour projects that involve small communities, and it's interesting because it's essentially a very, very similar language, the kind of the relationship of narrative and location.
You had an epiphany. Yeah. Great. John.
Just with regard to documentation for the project, I remember going back to my theatre, and I remember Manny bringing up a suggestion of there not being a book to document the
to not have a book, you mean? Well, I think the crucial thing about the series and the weirdness of the series is, as Claire said, that nobody saw all the works. It was because it was so dispersed across a number of sites. And I think even though there are always problems in relationship to using photographs as a way of standing in for the nuances of what happened across 24 hours, we felt very strongly that the book would be a place where the works would come together. It wouldn't be completed by any means. It wouldn't actually necessarily capture the entirety of the insanity of all the different experiences that took place, but that it would be the location in which the series could be understood holistically in some kinds of contexts.
Yeah, I think you also have... I think one also has to think about, for this kind of project, I mean, it's very similar to the different projects we've heard about in this lecture series, I think, which is that there are many different audiences for all of these projects at any one time. And I think that there are, for this series alone, there were lots and lots of very different kinds of audiences, some of which there were crowds for, some of which there were passers-by, some of which there were, you know, very, very few people that turned up to a particular project or made the effort, the journey to see it. And then there's the online audience who, for every single project, we commissioned a writer to be present and did an immediate critical response, which went up online. And that was a way of articulating the projects to a broad audience internationally. And then there's, you know, the specialist art audience who want to go in deep into the projects, and that's what the book's for. So it's for, to be fair to those New Zealand artists in particular, but also to the other international artists, that the projects have a life beyond those 24 hours, you know, all of that effort, so that there's some documentation, but also so that you can reflect back on those different kinds of projects and go in deep, as we say. And we just started editing it, and I think that the projects deserve that articulation of the ideas that are there. And that might not be for an audience who, some of the audiences who saw the projects on the ground, if you like.
Said we didn't have any funding, actually.
Yeah.
There's nothing. Put too fine a point.
I mean, it's really interesting, isn't it? Often these things happen, serendipitous moments. I think if we had been 2 years later, we wouldn't have done it. We couldn't have done it. So we just caught, it was just before the recession hit. So it's like 2007, beginning of 2007, we started a fundraise. And the overall cost of the project is about £1 million, pounds, something like that. And so it's... in terms of what we had to raise from various different locations. But the first funding that we got was the Wellington City Council Public Art Fund. And that absolutely was the bedrock on which all the other funding applications were built, because I think it was there... You know, it's interesting in relation to this series being, you know, supported and organised by the City Council, because I think it's kind of about the difference that a City Council can make to changing perceptions about what public art can be. But yeah, I think it would be very difficult to do now, actually, to raise that funding.
I think we're sort of fortunate in New Zealand that nothing like this had been tried before, so we had the benefit of newness on our side, in that when we went to approach various funders and pitch the project, we could say this is the first time a series like this had ever happened, the first time that every institution in the country had worked together. So there are a whole range of things that I could use the first time round to maybe build leverage for funding. But yeah, we were surprised at how we managed to pull the money together.
Yeah.
Pleasantly surprised.
And you know, clearly the project is a very brave and you know, innovative strategy in terms of counteracting what is commonplace in the art world in terms of, you know, the big green army comes to town, it's a big party, lots of champagne, and so forth, lots of money spent. Can you just talk about how that went? Because obviously there were expectations and if you were getting money.
Yeah.
We actually just had 20 parties
rather than one. Yeah, that would be nice.
Each project had a party.
Yeah, I mean, I think partly as a curatorial initiative or a model, if you like, it was that emphasis on each project, you know, on the autonomous nature of each project, and the fact that, in essence, we were believing that each project should be able to reach a new audience, if you like, in those different, very different locations. And so part of the funding, I think, was about saying that we can build an international reputation for New Zealand through a project like this without necessarily creating an event exhibition which, you know, attracts international visitors. The symposium, I think, was quite an important high point of the series because what that allowed for was 3 days around which there were a number of projects over that week for international visitors to come to the symposium. So there was a kind of 3 days of discussions and talks and presentations of work from elsewhere as well. And I think that was quite important in terms of an international profile. But, you know, it's been tough, though, because in terms of international press, it's just starting. Now the series is finished. And it's just been taken up in freeze and things, but it's incredibly difficult to sell a project on the basis that very few people will get to see it.
In fact, to begin with, we didn't get funding from Create New Zealand, which is the national funding agency, because two members of the panel thought, A, there was no context for this work, and B, why would we fund it to this level when it only happens for one day? So I certainly think that the difficulty for us was to try and convince them of the value of playing with that notion of temporary duration. And it was a sell. It wasn't something that just we could go bang and it happened. Mm-hmm. It took a number of applications and it took time before we could actually imbue people with thinking it had that value.
And it also required, I think, a change in visitor habits as well. I mean, I remember talking to the first artist, Maddie Leach, and she was crestfallen at midnight of her project because she said, I've worked on this bloody project for 6 months and it's over. She said, it's like an opening and a closing in the same day. You know, and there was this kind of realisation that it was very fleeting and that therefore, if you know, unlike all of us who, you know, go and see a show maybe in the last week and think, I meant to have seen that, you know, it had to require you to be there as if you were going to an opening and therefore demanded of you as a visitor in the various different locations an immediacy, which was quite interesting to watch and to see how that demanded a very different kind of thing. And in fact, what we noticed happened was that the art world attendance dropped off a little bit in the middle and the broader audiences increased, so that you had this kind of art world feeling like, yeah, I've kind of seen some of these, but a broader audience getting more interested. And you know, so on a number of the projects, our media liaison person was on the street kind of listening to what people were saying. Someone turned to somebody else and said, oh yeah, it's what they call a one-day sculpture. So there's this kind of, you know, terminology that was beginning to then kind of get taken up and things, which is quite interesting. Yeah.
Right at the back.
Yeah.
Right. From the interesting what you said about New Zealand, can we bring New Zealand to the forefront of the... So from there I moved to the... I can see when the seashore went, the local people went out and found a
wouldn't say that. I think if you look at, let's just say, the Festival for Ronald Hugh Morrison is very much geared around the specific person in New Zealand history. I think Lara Almafagi's very particular interest in temporary housing, which, for whatever reason, New Zealand moves houses around. So I think sometimes it's not overt. It's not necessarily overt in the way that the seaweed work might be or the open work might be. But I think every work in its own right does definitely engage with the idea of an aspect of the place that it's occupying.
You know, it's funny because I think on these kinds of projects you really learn as a curator. And the one thing I really changed my mind on is because of situations work, you know, we've been very interested in how artists engage with place and shift notions of place through what they do. And we've done projects with archaeologists and we've looked at methods of field research and all those sorts of things and field work. And actually, the more I worked on this project, the more I felt that I was more interested in an artist who kind of understood the conditions or were informed by the particular places they wanted to create a work, but didn't necessarily want to reference that literally. And I think the more successful projects were those that understood those conditions and then created something which was totally unexpected and couldn't be kind of tracked to a sort of New Zealand-ness or a Wellington-ness. And I think that it's increasingly those projects which... that was why it was so important that all the artists came out on research visits. But in some cases, in Thomas Hirschhorn's case, he came for 3 days, which, given a 27-hour flight from Europe, is insane. But he absolutely understood Sumner and those boy races, and he absolutely understood what was appropriate from his practice to do there. And his project unfolded beautifully. And when he came out to produce the project, he was with the project for the whole 24 hours. And for me, you know, that's a big learning curve, I think, as a curator, to move away from that notion that the artist has to come for a residency and be there for 3 months and really understand the context. Because in his case... because I don't think...
How can you understand the New Zealandness of the boy racer if you don't understand what boy racers are, placelessness?
I think the important thing is that the most successful projects were those that picked up on the conditions of that particular place but created something wholly unexpected and were sensitive to it but created something quite different, I think.
I'm just wondering about certain things, aspects you've brought up, the unexpected, sense of newness, spectacle. Mm.
Good question, Jono.
I don't think it's dead. I certainly think that we didn't set out with a series to construct a binary between the idea of temporary sculpture as good, permanent sculpture as bad. And I come back to that Billy Apple
true.
Work, but what I found really interesting is that I have no interest in Henry Moore as a sculptor, but Billy Apple got me interested in thinking about Henry Moore's practice in a way that I would never have thought about before. Mm. So I guess maybe it's somehow that perhaps temporary sculpture has an ability to in a sense, inflect certain ideas around the permanent and to have an interesting dialogue around those two things. And certainly there were aspects of the series where artists were ambivalent about the idea of permanence, but there were other works at the same time that simply were trying to find ways to talk about permanence but in a different way or have a dialogue with it. So
I ended up... the profound effect of this series on my thinking for permanent work, which we've just commenced in the Southwest now, is something around imagination, space for the imagination. Because I think some of the projects that for me were the most significant, successful, were actually strangely those projects you can talk across all of those ideas. You know, you can talk across in terms of the formation of a temporary community, of narrative, of intervention, of materiality. because they hold up, you know, they have so many dimensions to them. And I think, for example, Maddie's project was a really tough one to be the first project, because it's quite subtle in terms of what it delivers. But I think, for example, it's still there, the boat shed, you know, it still exists, but it's closed, you know, it's not the project. But as a permanent space, it could be fascinating as a space for a meeting point or a space for contemplation. So I guess how I've begun to think differently about permanent works is the possibilities for how it changes one's perception of the environment in terms of imagination. And certainly in terms of the work Paul O'Neill's been doing with situations around spaces for the unplanned, which I think is quite interesting as well. So rather than it being permanent public artwork being a focal point, it could potentially be something that opens out and allows things to happen in and with it or in and around it somehow.
How did the artist respond to the invitation to do a one-day sculpture? They heard about the audience, but did they find it difficult to deal? Obviously, they've all done a piece, but they must have had a response and be quite interested to share that with
them. Yeah. I think that was one of the things that the question that we've asked most often, because as ever with these kind of projects, there's the fear that the curatorial frame is too dominant, and would it have been better to simply approach artists to produce a series of commissions that could have occurred on their own terms in their own time frames? But actually, strangely, almost all of the artists responded really positively to the idea of a 24-hour parameter, and in very different ways. So in some cases, like Bedwa, for example, really took on the durational kind of madcap characteristic of it, and others ignored the 24-hour duration but liked the sense of the dayness. What is it about a day? And I think that was quite important why it wasn't 24-hour sculpture. Was a one day, so it was much more about the nature of the day and how we understand that in terms of time, in terms of anniversaries and commemorations and those sorts of things. What was tricky, I think, was sometimes more so to do with the curators and the artists, actually, which was to do with an understanding that it wasn't 24 hours from midday one day to midday the next, which was initially proposed by some of the curators. So we were quite specific that we wanted each artist to have their own day, so that it kind of was bracketed in those terms. But only in the sense that any commission has its own parameters, you know, or exhibition for that matter, so whether it's a 6-week duration or a 24-hour duration. But we also weren't too die hard about the parameters. So, for example, in some cases, as I say, projects have gone on to be made into films. In other cases, work still exists after that day. So, and of course, a work doesn't simply exist within its own 24 hours. It, you know, continues in all sorts of manifestations. It's just that the public presentation of that work occurred in that 24 hours, if you like. But I think there was only one or two projects where the artist said, I'm not really interested in that. And we continued having conversations about whether or not they wanted to do a project. Alara, for example, wasn't really interested in the fact that it was a day. But actually the fact that she produced something in a newspaper obviously kind of dealt with that temporal quality of it. I think most of the artists felt that it was a sort of challenge, you know, and took it on those terms. There was a kind of perversity for the international artists in coming to New Zealand and making a project for 24 hours.
Which is the period it takes to get there.
Yeah, exactly. We did have a few sort of FedEx proposals. You know, artists wanted to FedEx something, and the duration that it would take for the work to arrive in New Zealand would be the work, which luckily kind of fell by the wayside. But,
not knowing what they were going to produce.
Yeah. We didn't do an open call for submissions. All the artists were invited. And what we did was David and I acted as curatorial directors of the series. And we had a project team at Litmus who basically managed the whole series. But I worked with the curators quite closely, and they proposed artists they wanted to work with me. And I think there was just one that I suggested they might want to come up with another artist, and that was because it was Rax Media Collective, and Rax had already done a project in New Zealand with this particular curator. So that curator actually then went on to choose Javier Tellez. So that was a really good choice. But in most cases, I think we suggest to all the proposed artists, and we commissioned six ourselves, so all of those were invited. So it was interesting how that played out in terms of profile of the artist, generation, media, and approach to get that balance across the series, really.
Say that again.
Preferred list.
Do you have a preferred list of artists that they'd like to use, or is it?
Ruth just asked if curators have their own preferred lists of artists.
Councils.
Yeah. Councils have their own preferred list. Yeah. No, not really. I mean, it in many cases, as I think we said, it was the opportunity for people to work with artists who'd never worked with before. So Enjoy Public Art Gallery hadn't worked with an international artist before, and they chose Bedwell Williams, and there were a number of other people who worked with artists before. But for instance, Cuckoo, who the artist run initiative in Auckland, and they worked with Kate Newby and Nick Austin. That was very much a collective process. So what was really interesting to watch was that each institution, as well as us really, obviously work through their standard conventional kind of curatorial approaches. So in some cases, the large National Museum, Te Papa, you know, had a sort of typical bureaucratic kind of system for selecting an artist and working with them, and the artist-run spaces were much more comfortable with working with this kind of work because they do that all the time. You know. Yeah. Tessa, did you?
I was just wondering what the legacy to all those organisations working together, I'm just thinking of, you know, it's sort of in Bristol, and we've tried to do that, and it's never really kind of continued. So interesting to know you're working at a sort of local and an international level, whether that's raised the bar and they wanted to continue in that way.
Well, we're still talking to each other, so that's a good sign.
Yeah.
No, but I think that really is one of the great successes of the series, regardless of how we see the individual commissions, is that, you know, we managed to bring an entire country's art world together to engage in a project. And at the same time, you know, following on from the previous question, we wanted to give agency to curators to make decisions without it compromising the overarching sense of the series. So there's a lot of delicate balancing that went on. But at the end of the day, I would really much like to think that we will continue to find ways of engaging together, because I think that the good thing about New Zealand is that it's small enough to enable us to have been able to achieve that. But the next stage is, can we sustain that? And I think, yeah, it'll be really interesting. I really hope we can, because it's a nice way of breaking down the partisanness of the art world.
But it's, you know, what's really interesting about it is, for me, it became really obvious that these kinds of projects are about personalities, actually. And they're about those individual curators and their passion for working this way. And that's not to say that the institutions and the staff at the institutions or the organisations didn't make these things happen. But ultimately, it was about those 13 individuals and those conversations we had back at the end of 2006 and saying, should we make something happen? You know, and it's like lapdogs, you know, upstairs. It's the same, you know, a group of people wanting to make something happen. And many of those curators will go on. They'll leave New Zealand. You know, they may sort of move about between institutions, which happens a lot in New Zealand. And I think there's that character to it, that what it's left behind is hopefully a new set of curatorial skills and a passion for working outside of those conventional ways and time frames and buildings, etc. And then I think that gets, you know, begins to transform institutions from within, but because of those personalities, and there's a lot of really talented young curators there And I think their influence now is this upcoming generation, when they begin to be the directors of those spaces, you know, could have profound effect, I think. Mm-hmm. Yeah. On that note. Okay, go on then, you can be the last one. I think it's a fair point. I mean, I think that there's an argument to say that there is that diverse sector of art practice which is much more collaborative in its process. And there were a number of projects that included that, and there were a number of projects that weren't. And I think that in its breadth, the series shows those different kinds of approaches. There were studio practitioners, like Michael Paracourt-Fye, you know, who has a studio and technicians and produces a, you know, an object. And there were Liz Allen's projects, which was absolutely about giving voice and a sense of that kind of dialogic, you know, practice. I mean, I think the slight danger is a notion that, which we wanted to get away from, which is that because something appears, like the Morrison's Barricade, for example, overnight and is object-based, that it isn't therefore somehow doesn't involve the public. Now, of course it does. I mean, what's interesting about this piece is that people began to use it to have their photographs taken as a tourist site throughout that day. See, there's all these photographs on Flickr on kind of tourists, you know, taking photographs of each other in front of it. So, you know, if you understand, not to finish the lecture by getting into Jacques Rancière, God forbid, but if you understand Jacques Rancière's writing, the notion that we're all actors in the everyday, then the way in which you respond to this work, to this spectacle, and how it affects your life and how you take what your action is in response to it, means that you are participating within it. So I think that I wouldn't want to create a sort of binary division between collaborative practice and non-collaborative practice, because I think there's lots of different levels of the ways in which such work requires participation. Just as the Ivan Heather Morrison's lorry, which crash, which was staged in Bristol, then ensued into this kind of participatory work in which 25,000 flowers were spread across the city, and that became a participatory work, but it wasn't framed as such. It wasn't framed as a relational work, if you like. That's just one aspect of it, I think. Does that help sort of answer a bit? Okay. Any more? Thank you. Thanks very much.